Welcome to test number 4 of the test-based listening comprehension package developed at the Department of English Language Pedagogy. The listening material is recorded on CD, and the tasks and instructions are printed in your test booklet. There will be a series of tasks, and the recordings will be played twice. Before listening to each recording, you will be given some time to read the instructions and to look at the task in your test booklet. Remember that the instructions are not read out to you in this test. The whole test is about 50 minutes long. Task 1. Now read the instructions and start studying the task. Now listen to the recording.
Yeah, I own the world. An empty, dead, silent world.
Last Man on Earth is a 1964 survival horror film set in a post-apocalypse. A plague killed off every known human being except for the last survivor, Robert Morgan, played by Vincent Price. The corpses of the dead reanimate themselves and are all hell-bent on killing Morgan, so he has his hands full trying to find food, shelter, all while using his survival tactics to defend himself from the undead. This sounds familiar, right? Night of the Living Dead, which came out later, is the one everyone, including myself, has always praised as being the first zombie movie of its kind, but take a look at this. Did I just blow your mind? Even weirder, the movie takes place 4 years into the future, 1968, the year Night of the Living Dead came out. It's true George Romero had taken zombies to a new height and paved the way for a whole genre. Every zombie movie to this day is basically ripping off George Romero, but Romero was taking some elements that were already existing. The first zombie movie was White Zombie, 1932, but those zombies were mindless slaves and didn't have an appetite for human flesh. In 1959, there were at least two movies that dealt with aliens resurrecting the dead for world domination, Plan 9 from Outer Space, and Invisible Invaders, where aliens from the moon hide in human corpses and lumber about like zombies. The word zombie wasn't really in fashion at the time. In Last Man on Earth, they aren't technically zombies, they're vampires. The movie explicitly calls them that. They can't stand sunlight, Morgan fends them off with mirrors and garlic, and impales them with a wooden stake. Even though they walk like zombies, they're more intelligent and can talk.
Morgan! We're going to kill you, Morgan!
So basically, before our famous traditional Romero zombies, there were voodoo zombies, alien zombies, and vampire zombies. Yeah. The film is slow-moving, especially since it has one lone character. A great deal of it is shown in flashback while other people are alive, but the majority of it is Vincent Price acting alone, which you have to give him a lot of credit for carrying so much of the movie on his own. Movies depend so much on whether the actors are any good. If this were anyone else, this could have been a huge bore, but with Vincent Price, you can't go wrong. I wouldn't call it a magnificent film. It's more like a minor classic that is often overlooked. I won't overhype it. I'll just say it's worth checking out, mostly for curiosity's sake, because the whole zombie dystopian apocalypse genre owes so much to it, and it's public domain, so you can find it anywhere. It was based on the 1954 novel by Richard Matheson, but the novel was called I Am Legend. It was remade in 1971, starring Charlton Heston, titled The Omega Man, and again in 2011, starring Will Smith. This time they finally honored the title of the book. I do understand why they called the first adaptation Last Man on Earth, because it's much more descriptive. But here's something that always confused me. In 1959, the first Twilight Zone episode aired, Where Is Everybody? It's about a man who finds himself all alone and searches the town for signs of life. There's a scene where he finds a rack of books titled The Last Man on Earth. It makes me wonder if the film Last Man on Earth took its inspiration from that episode, and strange enough, author Richard Matheson actually wrote many Twilight Zone episodes. Last Man on Earth was also the title of a 1924 film, a 2011 film, and a 2015 TV series. So, a word of advice, if you're making a movie about a man who's the last on Earth, call it something different, like, final surviving person on the planet?
Now listen to the recording again.
Yeah, I own the world. An empty, dead, silent world.
Last Man on Earth is a 1964 survival horror film set in a post-apocalypse. A plague killed off every known human being except for the last survivor, Robert Morgan, played by Vincent Price. The corpses of the dead reanimate themselves and are all hell-bent on killing Morgan, so he has his hands full trying to find food, shelter, all while using his survival tactics to defend himself from the undead. This sounds familiar, right? Night of the Living Dead, which came out later, is the one everyone, including myself, has always praised as being the first zombie movie of its kind, but take a look at this. Did I just blow your mind? Even weirder, the movie takes place 4 years into the future, 1968, the year Night of the Living Dead came out. It's true George Romero had taken zombies to a new height and paved the way for a whole genre. Every zombie movie to this day is basically ripping off George Romero, but Romero was taking some elements that were already existing. The first zombie movie was White Zombie, 1932, but those zombies were mindless slaves and didn't have an appetite for human flesh. In 1959, there were at least two movies that dealt with aliens resurrecting the dead for world domination, Plan 9 from Outer Space, and Invisible Invaders, where aliens from the moon hide in human corpses and lumber about like zombies. The word zombie wasn't really in fashion at the time. In Last Man on Earth, they aren't technically zombies, they're vampires. The movie explicitly calls them that. They can't stand sunlight, Morgan fends them off with mirrors and garlic, and impales them with a wooden stake. Even though they walk like zombies, they're more intelligent and can talk.
Morgan! We're going to kill you, Morgan!
So basically, before our famous traditional Romero zombies, there were voodoo zombies, alien zombies, and vampire zombies. Yeah. The film is slow-moving, especially since it has one lone character. A great deal of it is shown in flashback while other people are alive, but the majority of it is Vincent Price acting alone, which you have to give him a lot of credit for carrying so much of the movie on his own. Movies depend so much on whether the actors are any good. If this were anyone else, this could have been a huge bore, but with Vincent Price, you can't go wrong. I wouldn't call it a magnificent film, it's more like a minor classic that is often overlooked. I won't overhype it, I'll just say it's worth checking out, mostly for curiosity's sake, because the whole zombie dystopian apocalypse genre owes so much to it, and it's public domain, so you can find it anywhere. It was based on the 1954 novel by Richard Matheson, but the novel was called I Am Legend. It was remade in 1971, starring Charlton Heston, titled The Omega Man, and again in 2011, starring Will Smith. This time they finally honored the title of the book. I do understand why they called the first adaptation Last Man on Earth, because it's much more descriptive. But here's something that always confused me. In 1959, the first Twilight Zone episode aired, Where Is Everybody? It's about a man who finds himself all alone and searches the town for signs of life. There's a scene where he finds a rack of books titled The Last Man on Earth. It makes me wonder if the film Last Man on Earth took its inspiration from that episode, and strange enough, author Richard Matheson actually wrote many Twilight Zone episodes. Last Man on Earth was also the title of a 1924 film, a 2011 film, and a 2015 TV series. So, a word of advice, if you're making a movie about a man who's the last on Earth, call it something different, like, final surviving person on the planet?
That is the end of Task 1. Task 2. Now read the instructions and start studying the task. Now listen to the recording.
Corvettes at Carlisle is a pilgrimage for GM geeks that is only vaguely related to fiberglass-bodied V8 sports cars.
Carlisle, the town itself, looks like a town from an old Hollywood musical. Maybe Bye Bye Birdie or The Music Man. This place probably still sells milk in bottles. They probably have it delivered, too.
The Carlisle Fairgrounds is many acres, and for Corvette Weekend, it's used to its capacity. As you approach the Carlisle Fairgrounds, you're gonna see this beautiful tableau. Front yard swindlers were on Clay Street. Clay Street is a street that leads right to the Carlisle Fairgrounds in Carlisle. Homeowners wore generic reflective vests over top Bass Pro Shop t-shirts, and they waved orange flags at passing cars. And when a Corvette of any year approached, they waved even harder, and they pointed with practice authority at their front lawns.
You, park here. Yeah, you, right over here.
And painted squares of oriented strand board were leaned up against trees. On it bore the words, save your feet, park here, $10. The more successful parking succubuses pointed right at cars, zeroing in on ones with out-of-state plates. In nonverbal communication, they said,
you, park here.
And the bewildered golden oldies Virginian couple in a C4 obeyed. Another $10. Anyway, we entered the fairgrounds, and there inside were all the Corvettes immediately lined up and being fed by tents and nursing stations.
Corvettes at Carlisle is different from something like the New York International Auto Show. Aside from being more provincial, it's also home to a more confident clientele. These are people with roots, and the certainty of self and belonging that goes along with those connections. These are people who don't need to do any of the douchey things that people tend to do at auto shows. Nobody steals shift knobs, nobody leans on a stranger's car or even breathes on it without asking first. Everybody is respectful, almost to a religious degree.
50 years young, married lovers wear matching Corvette baseball caps and press novelty signs into the grass. Grand Sport parking only. Attendees drifted among the vendors, and some of the vendors had pop-up fake storefronts outfitted with generators which powered elliptical seizure LED extravaganza signs.
Corvette Parts USA.
On the other end of the economic spectrum, vendors spread rubber or nylon tarps down on the earth and spread out rows of water pumps and electrics. I was checking my watch. Corvettes at Carlisle has a main event, the subtle purpose of which is to break your precious build. It's a 2-mile parade route performed with a long wait time at idle, and then a slow crawl through town. Let's see if your high lift and long duration cams and fruit splash gusher carb jets can handle this kind of premeditated abuse. The daring owners lined up their cars at 5 p.m., and I was invited to ride along in a white C4.
No matter what you think of Corvettes themselves or the kind of culture they cultivate, it's hard not to respect the amount of dedication that goes into Corvette ownership. We've reviewed several, and we've yet to meet somebody who ever takes their responsibility lightly. And that's deserving of a certain respect in itself. Not everybody treats their cars like they deserve to be treated. Some people beat on their cars, or neglect their cars, or curse their cars out. And sometimes it's not the car's fault. Sometimes it's the owner bringing his own issues to the car, hissing and moaning about his own lousy choices and failing to recognize that he's actually sitting on the one good choice he made. It's rare to find a neglectful Corvette owner, because they understand that a car isn't just a car. It can be part of your family. It can be part of your life. It can be part of your identity. The DNA of what makes you, you, at a level that extends past biology. It can be something more than the sum of its parts, just as the owner can be more than just a guy with an upholstery business.
These people have a community tighter than any subreddit could hope to weave. They've been coming to Carlisle since I was paying for elementary food with lunch tickets. They have friendships, bound through wrenching rescues and emergency tows and fiberglass repair and maddening C4 spark plug changing procedures. I have none of this. I am a cynical poser with a clipboard and sour grapes. I see people who have solid foundations on which to build their place in this world, Corvettes or not. They have lasting families and hold hands as they walk. Their children are respectful and their dogs only pee in the long grass. There are no drunken police encounters or even that much profanity. If there was an overreaching feel to that Saturday, it was this. I want in. I want into this world. Not to command an LS engine, no, but to join these Corvette owners in their beanbag sense of belonging to each other.
Now listen to the recording again.
Corvettes at Carlisle is a pilgrimage for GM geeks that is only vaguely related to fiberglass-bodied V8 sports cars. Carlisle, the town itself, looks like a town from an old Hollywood musical. Maybe Bye Bye Birdie or The Music Man. This place probably still sells milk in bottles. They probably have it delivered, too.
The Carlisle Fairgrounds is many acres, and for Corvette weekend, it's used to its capacity. As you approach the Carlisle Fairgrounds, you're gonna see this beautiful tableau. Front yard swindlers were on Clay Street. Clay Street is a street that leads right to the Carlisle Fairgrounds in Carlisle. Homeowners wore generic reflective vests over top Bass Pro Shop t-shirts, and they waved orange flags at passing cars. And when a Corvette of any year approached, they waved even harder, and they pointed pointed with practice authority at their front lawns.
You, park here. Yeah, you, right over here.
And painted squares of oriented strand board were leaned up against trees. On it bore the words, save your feet, park here, $10. The more successful parking succubuses pointed right at cars, zeroing in on ones with out-of-state plates. In nonverbal communication, they said,
you, park here.
And the bewildered golden oldies Virginian couple in a C4 obeyed. Another $10. Anyway, we entered the fairgrounds, and there inside were all the Corvettes immediately lined up and being fed by tents and nursing stations.
Corvettes at Carlisle is different from something like the New York International Auto Show. Aside from being more provincial, it's also home to a more confident clientele. These are people with roots, and the certainty of self and belonging that goes along with those connections. These are people who don't need to do any of the douchey things that people tend to do at auto shows. Nobody steals shift knobs. Nobody leans on a stranger's car or even breathes on it without asking first. Everybody is respectful, almost to a religious degree.
50 years young, married lovers wear matching Corvette baseball caps and press novelty signs into the grass. Grand sport parking only. Attendees drifted among the vendors, and some of the vendors had pop-up fake storefronts outfitted with generators which powered elliptical seizure LED extravaganza signs.
Corvette Parts USA.
On the other end of the economic spectrum, vendors spread rubber or nylon tarps down on the earth and spread out rows of water pumps and electrics. I was checking my watch. Corvettes at Carlisle has a main event, the subtle purpose of which is to break your precious build. It's a 2-mile parade route performed with a long wait time at idle, and then a slow crawl through town. Let's see if your high lift and long duration cams and fruit splash gusher carb jets can handle this kind of premeditated abuse. The daring owners lined up their cars at 5 p.m., and I was invited to ride along in a white C4.
No matter what you think of Corvettes themselves or the kind of culture they cultivate, it's hard not to respect the amount of dedication that goes into Corvette ownership. We've reviewed several, and we've yet to meet somebody who ever takes their responsibility lightly, and that's deserving of a certain respect in itself. Not everybody treats their cars like they deserve to be treated. Some people beat on their cars, or neglect their cars, or curse their cars out. And sometimes it's not the car's fault. Sometimes it's the owner bringing his own issues to the car, hissing and moaning about his own lousy choices and failing to recognize that he's actually sitting on the one good choice he made. It's rare to find a neglectful Corvette owner, because they understand that a car isn't just a car. It can be part of your family. It can be part of your life. It can be part of your identity. The DNA of what makes you, you, at a level that extends past biology. It can be something more than the sum of its parts, just as the owner can be more than just a guy with an upholstery business.
These people have a community tighter than any subreddit could hope to weave. They've been coming to Carlisle since I was paying for elementary food with lunch tickets. They have friendships, bound through wrenching rescues and emergency tows and fiberglass repair and maddening C4 spark plug changing procedures. I have none of this. I am a cynical poser with a clipboard and sour grapes. I see people who have solid foundations on which to build their place in this world, Corvettes or not. They have lasting families and hold hands as they walk. Their children are respectful and their dogs only pee in the long grass. There are no drunken police encounters or even that much profanity. If there was an overreaching feel to that Saturday, it was this. I want in. I want into this world. Not to command an LS engine, no, but to join these Corvette owners in their beanbag sense of belonging to each other.
That is the end of Task 2. Task 3. Now read the instructions and start studying the task. Now listen to the recording.
The Tamman Shud Case. Considered to be one of Australia's most enduring and baffling mysteries, the Tamman Shud case is still the subject of intense speculation about what exactly happened to the unidentified man who was found on Somerton Beach in Adelaide. It all began on November 1, 1948 at 6:30 a.m, when a man's body was found lying on the sand with his head resting against the seawall. At first it was thought he had died while sleeping, as witnesses came forward and reported that they had seen a man lying against the wall the night before, but assumed he was drunk. Then police found an unlit cigarette resting on the collar of his coat. After searching his pockets to try and confirm his identity, all that was found was an unusual rail ticket, a bus ticket, cigarettes, matches, and a comb. The pathologist's report stated he was of British appearance, 5'11" tall, with fair to ginger-coloured hair, and was thought to be aged around 40 to 45. He was smartly dressed but had no hat or wallet, which was unusual for 1948. And even more bizarre was the fact that all of the labels in his clothes had been cut out and his entire body was freshly clean shaven. His teeth did not match any dental records of any known living person, and the autopsy showed several enlarged organs and congestion, and also revealed that his last meal was a pasty, but it didn't reveal what his cause of death was, which almost certainly was not natural causes. Poisoning was a possibility, but no foreign substance could be found in the man's body. Despite the police circulating his photograph worldwide, no one credible came forward to identify the man, and by November 1953, 251 members of the public came forward, claiming to have known or met the man, but all were disproved as just looking for media attention. At the inquest into the man's death, although not found in his body, the possibility of poisoning was discussed, and a substance was suggested by a professor that could poison someone without leaving any trace. But despite this suggestion, the cause of death was still reported as unknown. To add even more mystery to this case, a while after the man had been found dead, a tiny rolled-up piece of paper was found in a fob pocket sewn into the dead man's trousers. The words printed on it were Tamman Shud, which translated in Persian means ended or finished. Public library officials later confirmed that this could be found on the last page of a rare New Zealand book, and after the verse was circulated to the public, someone came forward and claimed he had found a copy of the book in the back seat of an unlocked car that was parked near the spot where the man's body was found, and tests later confirmed that the piece of paper was torn from this book. There were also some pencil markings in the back of the book that looked like some sort of code, but despite extensive investigations, it was not deciphered, and there was still no conclusive evidence of how the man died, who he was, or why he had this piece of paper sewn into his trousers. Lots of names have been linked to the man's mysterious death, and there is even speculation that he was a government spy, but nothing has ever been proved. So, could his death have been the result of a perfect murder, or was it a case of poison suicide by a man who did not appear to have anyone who would have missed him? The man's body was eventually laid to rest in Adelaide's West Terrace Cemetery, and some years after the burial, a woman started leaving flowers on the grave. She was questioned by police, but claimed she knew nothing of the man and was just showing her respect. Mysteriously, over the years, much of the evidence has just disappeared, and it seems even the autopsy notes are missing from public record. So maybe it was the intention all along, that the Somerton man was never meant to be identified.
Now listen to the recording again.
The Tamman Shud Case. Considered to be one of Australia's most enduring and baffling mysteries, the Tamman Shud case is still the subject of intense speculation about what exactly happened to the unidentified man who was found on Somerton Beach in Adelaide. It all began on November 1, 1948 at 6:30 a.m, when a man's body was found lying on the sand with his head resting against the seawall. At first it was thought he had died while sleeping, as witnesses came forward and reported that they had seen a man lying against the wall the night before, but assumed he was drunk. Then police found an unlit cigarette resting on the collar of his coat. After searching his pockets to try and confirm his identity, all that was found was an unusual rail ticket, a bus ticket, cigarettes, matches, and a comb. The pathologist's report stated he was of British appearance, 5'11" tall, with fair to ginger-coloured hair, and was thought to be aged around 40 to 45. He was smartly dressed but had no hat or wallet, which was unusual for 1948. And even more bizarre was the fact that all of the labels in his clothes had been cut out and his entire body was freshly clean shaven. His teeth did not match any dental records of any known living person, and the autopsy showed several enlarged organs and congestion, and also revealed that his last meal was a pasty, but it didn't reveal what his cause of death was, which almost certainly was not natural causes. Poisoning was a possibility, but no foreign substance could be found in the man's body. Despite the police circulating his photograph worldwide, no one credible came forward to identify the man, and by November 1953, 251 members of the public came forward claiming to have known or met the man, but all were disproved as just looking for media attention. At the inquest into the man's death, although not found in his body, the possibility of poisoning was discussed, and a substance was suggested by a professor that could poison someone without leaving any trace. But despite this suggestion, the cause of death was still reported as unknown. To add even more mystery to this case, a while after the man had been found dead, a tiny rolled-up piece of paper was found in a fob pocket sewn into the dead man's trousers. The words printed on it were Taman Shud, which translated in Persian means ended or finished. Public library officials later confirmed that this could be found on the last page of a rare New Zealand book, and after the verse was circulated to the public, someone came forward and claimed he had found a copy of the book in the back seat of an unlocked car that was parked near the spot where the man's body was found, and tests later confirmed that the piece of paper was torn from this book. There were also some pencil markings in the back of the book that looked like some sort of code, but despite extensive investigations, it was not deciphered, and there was still no conclusive evidence of how the man died, who he was, or why he had this piece of paper sewn into his trousers. Lots of names have been linked to the man's mysterious death, and there is even speculation that he was a government spy, but nothing has ever been proved. So, could his death have been the result of a perfect murder, or was it a case of poison suicide by a man who did not appear to have anyone who would have missed him? The man's body was eventually laid to rest in Adelaide's West Terrace Cemetery, and some years after the burial, a woman started leaving flowers on the grave. She was questioned by police, but claimed she knew nothing of the man and was just showing her respect. Mysteriously, over the years, much of the evidence has just disappeared, and it seems even the autopsy notes are missing from public record. So maybe it was the intention all along, that the Somerton man was never meant to be identified.
That is the end of Task 3. Task 4. Now read the instructions and start studying the task. Now listen to the recording.
Here he is, though, to talk to us now this evening, Sir David Attenborough, ladies and gentlemen. How lovely to see you again, and thank you so much. It's always a thrill for me when you come on the show and agree to be interviewed, so thank you so much. You're just back at the moment. You're just back from China, just recently returned from China.
China, yeah.
And been filming out there, or is this a holiday?
Filming, yeah.
OK, what series is this for?
Fossils. Uh-huh. Feathered dinosaurs.
Wow.
Yeah, wonderful.
Because the birds, I believe, they have more in common with dinosaurs than most of the other animals.
They are descendants of dinosaurs.
I don't believe that, I'll be honest with you.
Get off.
Well, I've seen dinosaurs in films, and they're much bigger, for a start.
Have you ever been chased by an ostrich?
Actually, you know what? I have.
There you are. Then you believe it.
So did dinosaurs have feathered?
Absolutely.
All of them, even like the T-Rex?
Not all of them. The big brontosaurs didn't.
Wow.
But the smaller ones did. And you've got these wonderful fossils in which you see, if you saw just the bones, you would say, that's a dinosaur. But they've now got specimens in which you can see the imprint of the feathers all around.
And is this a new interest of yours, the whole idea of fossils and tracing animals back that far? You've always been into...
No, it was actually one of my first, really. I was brought up in the Midlands and I looked for fossils as a kid, and I've never stopped, really.
And did you have a fossil collection when you were a young man?
I have a few. Okay. A few legal ones.
Oh.
Yeah.
You smoked all the West, I imagine. So this is for another TV series. And what a productive period this has been for you, because there are three shows that have been on at the moment. Well, two are still on.
I'm afraid so, yeah.
And two more coming this year, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Wow, incredible. I mean, that's a remarkable workload for
anyone. When the offers are there, you have to take them, don't you?
Tell me about it. Mm. the one we have on at the moment, Africa, we see there, you're doing the one in China with fossils.
Mm.
What's the other show that you're making this year, the one that you haven't filmed yet or that we haven't seen yet?
There's one about fossils, as you say, and there's one about insects, which I'm doing.
OK, and where are you filming that? All over the world?
All over the world, yeah.
And what sort of new angle will you take on insects?
Yeah, well, that's in 3D.
So insects in 3D. And yet you're an animal... would you call yourself an animal lover, or is it just an academic interest?
I'm absolutely fascinated by animals, that's right. I mean, the word lover is a sort of, you know, funny old word. Well, it is, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, I don't love snails particularly,
no.
but they are very interesting, actually. They're Have you ever seen snails mating?
I've probably seen them on one of your shows,
yes,
doing that kind of thing, but
slugs
I haven't.
Slugs are even more exciting.
I saw one creature... See, I'm a bit worried about the level of enthusiasm you're showing for the mating habits of snails. But when you're filming, do you get to see that firsthand, that kind of thing, or is it always you see what the cameraman's brought back?
Oh, nearly always it's what the cameraman's done. I mean, I sometimes have the privilege of writing the scripts, you know, and I say, close-up lion as it approaches something or other, you see.
Yeah.
And they say, how do you expect to get that? And I say, that's your problem, mate.
they do get some incredible shots. How difficult is it? You know, you mentioned the bravery and certainly the dedication of the cameramen you work with. How risky is it what they're doing? I mean, presumably sometimes they are in very real danger.
For me, hardly at all. but the cameramen... They've got a camera, you know, and the funny thing is, when you're looking down a camera, you get absorbed in the program and you forget you forget that it's going on down there. And even when it starts to run towards you, you think this is a terrific shot, and you suddenly really look up and it's only just about 5 yards away.
Yeah. And that brings me to a different question, because occasionally people obviously ask you questions about the state of the planet and whether you believe in climate change, whether you believe that that's happening, whether you believe that the preservation of animals is necessary, or you should let them fend for themselves. Would you save humans over other animals? Do you think the planet would be better off without us?
If we behave better, we're capable of behaving better than we're doing at the moment. We aren't fully aware of the consequences of what we're doing most of the time. And if we behave better, we have the power to make everything better for everything else, which is more than you can say for almost any other species. So we have the potential of making things much better. At the moment, we're making them much worse. So it's time we wised up.
It's time we took responsibility for action. I think that's... I don't think anyone would disagree with that, and it's lovely to hear it from you. David's new series at the moment, or one of the new series, but the one that's just started, is called David Attenborough's Natural Curiosities. It's on Tuesdays on the Eden Channel. I saw the first episode the other night. OK, I've got something under my desk for you. Look at this little fella here. Let me pass them over to you. And they're arboreal, so they like to be high, don't they? So I think if I go down low and you put your finger there... Look at that, and you've handled these little fellas before, of course. I love the way the hands work. They're kind of like... It's almost like they have two big fingers.
They are among the most beautiful things in the world. Look at that.
Okay, he's climbing up onto you there.
Come on.
Look at that.
Look at that.
And they change their colour when threatened, or indeed when they wish to threaten, when they want to impose their will on another animal.
They get angry. If they get angry, they go black. This chap's not in the least angry. And isn't he just one of the most beautiful things? Look at that. Come on, then. You want to travel?
Oh, I've got a little tiny fella here. Look at this one here. And so they like to be high, is that right? So if you put them on my shoulder, he'll probably like that, I think. And also he makes for... Oh, no, hold it, he's... Why, he's defying nature, this beast. I think you found it. Look at that. Look at his little... Wow. And they don't cohabitate happily, do they? I believe they like to be on their own if they're...
They are solitary hunters, by and large. And, of course, the great thing about them is that they have this fantastic...
I don't know what happened.
I used to have a tame one, and I used to take him out in the garden in London, and it had this huge tongue, of course, and I used to point him at a fly sitting on a flower, and he'd go, see, and wallop, get the fly. Wow.
We should say, I mean, people, I mean, I'm falling in love with this little fella here. I don't think the feeling's mutual, but... We should point out that they don't make suitable pets, and these are from a rescue centre. So I think people had them as pets, and they were taken in, and they've been looked after now.
They were born in this country, though. That's the great thing about these.
Their eyes, I believe, are they unique in that their eyes can face in different directions the same time? We're going to take a break. Will you join me in saying thank you, not just to our two chameleon friends, but also the one and only Sir David Attenborough?
Now listen to the recording again. Remember that this time we will play the recording in shorter sections to give you enough time to write down your answers.
Here he is, though, to talk to us now this evening, Sir David Attenborough, ladies and gentlemen. How lovely to see you again, and thank you so much. It's always a thrill for me when you come on the show and agree to be interviewed, so thank you so much. You're just back at the moment. You're just back from China, just recently returned from China.
China, yeah.
And been filming out there, or is this a holiday?
Yeah.
Okay, what series is this for?
Fossils. Uh-huh. Feathered dinosaurs.
Wow.
Yeah, wonderful.
Because the birds, I believe, they have more in common with dinosaurs than most of the other animals.
They are descendants of dinosaurs.
I don't believe that, I'll be honest with you.
Get off.
Well, I've seen dinosaurs in films, and they're much bigger, for a start.
Have you ever been chased by an ostrich?
Actually, you know what? I have.
There you are. Then you believe it.
So did dinosaurs have feathered...
Absolutely.
All of them, even like the T-Rex?
Not all of them. The big brontosaurs didn't.
Wow.
But the smaller ones did. And you've got these wonderful fossils in which you see... If you saw just the bones, you would say, that's a dinosaur. But they've now got specimens in which you can see the imprint of the feathers all around.
And is this a new interest of yours, the whole idea of fossils and tracing animals back that far? You've always been into...
No, it was actually one of my first, really. I was brought up in the Midlands, and I looked for fossils as a kid, and I've never stopped, really.
And did you have a fossil collection when you were a young man?
I have a few. Okay. A few legal ones.
Oh.
Yeah.
You smoked all the rest, I imagine. So this is for another TV series. What a productive period this has been for you, because there are three shows that have been on at the moment, or two are still on.
I'm afraid so, yeah.
And two more coming this year, is that
right? Yes, that's right.
Wow, incredible. I mean, that's a remarkable workload for
anyone. When the offers are there, you have to take them, don't you?
Tell me about it. Mm. the one we have on at the moment, Africa, we see there, you're doing the one in China with fossils. Mm. What's the other show that you're making this year, the one that you haven't filmed yet or that we haven't seen yet?
There's one about fossils, as you say, and there's one about insects, which I'm doing.
OK, and where are you filming that? All over the world?
All over the world, yeah.
And what sort of new angle will you take on insects?
Yeah, well, that's in 3D.
So insects in 3D. And yet you're, I mean, I guess you're an animal... would you call yourself an animal lover, or is it just an academic interest?
I'm absolutely
interest?
Fascinated by animals, that's right. I mean, the word lover is a sort of, you know, funny old word. Well, it is, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, I don't love snails particularly,
no.
but they are very interesting, actually. They're Have you ever seen snails mating?
I've probably seen them on one of your shows,
yes,
doing that kind of thing, but
slugs
I haven't...
Slugs are even more exciting.
I saw one creature...
Yeah.
See, I'm a bit worried about the level of enthusiasm you're showing for the mating habits of snails. But when you're filming, Do you get to see that firsthand, that kind of thing, or is it always you see what the cameraman's brought back?
Oh, nearly always it's what the cameraman's done. I mean, I sometimes have the privilege of writing the scripts, you know, and I say, close-up lion as it approaches something or other scene. Yeah. And they say, how do you expect to get that? And I say, that's your problem, mate.
they do get some incredible shots. How difficult is it? You know, you mentioned the bravery and certainly the dedication of the cameramen you work with. How risky is it what they're doing? I mean, presumably sometimes they are in very real danger.
For me, hardly at all. But for the cameramen... They've got a camera, you know, and that's quite, and the funny thing is when you're looking down a camera, you get absorbed in the program and you forget you forget that it's going on down there, and even when it starts to run towards you, you think this is a terrific shot, and you suddenly really look up and it's only just about 5 yards away.
Yeah. And that brings me to a different question, because occasionally people obviously ask you questions about the state of the planet and whether you believe in climate change, whether you believe that that's happening, whether you believe that the preservation of animals is necessary, or should let them fend for themselves. Would you save humans over other animals? Do you think the planet would be better off without us?
If we behave better, we're capable of behaving better than we're doing at the moment. We aren't fully aware of the consequences of what we're doing most of the time. And if we behave better, we have the power to make everything better for everything else, which is more than you can say for almost any other species. So we have the potential of making things much better. At the moment, we're making them much worse. So it's time we wised up.
It's time we took responsibility for action. I don't think anyone would disagree with that, and it's lovely to hear it from you. David's new series at the moment, or one of the new series, but the one that's just started, is called David Attenborough's Natural Curiosities. It's on Tuesdays on the Eden Channel. I saw the first episode the other night. OK, I've got something under my desk for you. Look at this little fella here. Let me pass them over to you. And they're arboreal, so they like to be high, don't they? So I think if I go down low and you put your finger there, look at that, and you've handled these little fellas before, of course. I love the way the hands work. They're kind of like... It's almost like they have two big fingers.
They are among the most beautiful things in the world. Look at that.
Okay, he's climbing up onto you there.
Come on.
Look at that.
Look at that.
And they change their colour when threatened, or indeed when they wish to threaten, when they want to impose their will on another animal.
They get angry. If they get angry, they go black. This chap's not in the least angry. And isn't he just one of the most beautiful things? Look at that. Come on, then. You want to travel? Oh,
I've got a little tiny fella here. Look at this one here. And so they like to be high, is that right? So if you put them on my shoulder, he'll probably like that, I think. And also he makes for... Oh, no, hold it, he's... Why, he's defying nature, this beast. I think we found it. Look at that. Look at his little... Wow. And they don't cohabitate happily, do they? I believe they like to be on their own if they're...
They are solitary hunters by and large. And, of course, the great thing about them is that they have this fantastic...
I don't know what happened.
I used to have a tame one, and I used to take him out in the garden in London, and it had this huge tongue, of course, and I used to point him at a fly sitting on a flower, and he'd go, see, and wallop, get the fly.
Wow. We should say, I mean, people, I mean, I'm falling in love with this little fella here. I don't think the feeling's mutual, but... We should point out that they don't make suitable pets, and these are from a rescue centre. So I think people had them as pet, and they were taken in, and they've been looked after now.
They were born in this country, though. That's the great thing about these.
Their eyes, I believe, are they unique in that their eyes can face in different directions
they
at
do.
The same time? We're going to take a break. Will you join me in saying thank you, not just to our two chameleon friends, but also the one and only Sir David Attenborough?
That is the end of Task 4, and also the end of the listening test.